We all tell ourselves stories of who we are and why. But we forget that we have the power to define them. That no idea grows from mewling striped cum to teeth at your throat tiger without a little help, some guidance, and a whole lot of love along the way. I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers. Hi all, I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers, the show about stories, those who create, and why. Here with me today is...
Hello, I am Andrew. Some of you may have heard me as the DM to the wonderful, wonderful stories Oberon Outer Worlds. Been on a couple episodes of Here Be Tigers. I think that Flight of Dragons episode was Here Be Tigers, I want to say.
Right. I think the Flight of Dragons one, we had you on for The Witcher along with Annie.
Yes. The show that we will never continue because two of us liked it, but one did not like it.
Dislike is a weak word for my feelings on that show.
Henry Cavill did nothing wrong.
It's not the actor's fault. That show just has a bad script and way too much of a fan base to stop. That's all I'm going to say about it. So, although, in a way, you've given us a great entry to our topic today, which is adaptations. We are going to be focusing on a particular kind today, which is changing from one genre to another. We'll touch upon other variations in future episodes, but I wanted to start with a conversation that Dave, Stephen, and I had with Pablo years ago as an offhanded or an aside, where we were playing a long-standing narrative game in one genre, and then what-ifed it as in, what if we did a spinoff for another variation, or if we took a break and tried these other versions and iterations?
Right.
I think fundamentally what that led us down to was a conversation about what changes in terms of character, in terms of tonality, in terms of truths of world and story. And I thought it would be interesting more so for the audience today to bring someone in that dialogue who is completely and utterly unfamiliar with the IP or the property we'll be talking about. And so could take it in directions that none of us would have thought of before. But before we go into the particulars, Andrew, you have a background in game and design, right?
Yeah, I'm studying to be a game designer through Ferris, originally started on the art track. Now I'm going to more general programming and that kind of thing. But I've been in that school field for quite a bit now. I'd say so.
What prompted the decision to go from aesthetic to the system end?
I wanted to do more, and I honestly felt like if I just stuck with the aesthetic end. Realistically, it's because I didn't think I would end up with a job, but on the other hand, it's because I also wanted to do more than just what the aesthetic side had for me. And right now, with my current program, I feel like I've got a good balance between the two, where it's like, okay, I can do good. I can do some stuff on the system end, and I can still keep the aesthetic end in mind, that kind of thing.
You'd have more complete creative control as a developer.
Exactly, yeah.
I've worked with some folks on the content and asset end, as the folks who were AAA artists before who left the industry, because it is...
It's just a big pile of fun.
Exhausting. That's a word I'll use, exhausting.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be polite for the moment. But I thought particularly to ask Andrew onto the show for this conversation, because when you discuss adaptations for property, an existing set of content and ideas, there's a lot that has to be eschewed fundamentally to make it work in either a different medium or even a different genre.
Yeah.
And I think, as I had suggested to you, the basic premise we were going to take was this narrative. We will share pieces of it from the old recordings that are in the archives right now, called Academy World, where I offhandedly said to Dave and Pablo and Stephen later, why don't we take a twist on the Harry Potter genre of magical school, but play off of the similar idea, perhaps the Magician's Book series, where what if you were less high school students or middle school students in college instead? And what shenanigans do you get up to then, right?
Right.
And the Magicians took it a very particular route, had an off-brand Narnia that they wove into it. The television series, I think, is probably the best adaptation of that narrative on the whole. But that premise quickly evolved into a world of its own that had a few particular hard and fast rules to it. The first of which was that the world was liminal and dying, that the way things were could no longer persist, and all the things that used to be were, if not already falling apart, doing so now. The second rule and corollary to that was that while the high fantasy tropes do persist, none of them are the same anymore. They've been warped or altered, changed, in some cases irrevocably and almost unrecognizably at first.
Okay.
The third was something that emerged out of the play itself in the earliest sessions. I think beyond the initial shenanigans of them trying to get to the school, they were then given an opportunity to find a place within the academy to make their home. The doyen, the grand doyen, told them there were some abandoned portions of the academy that could be turned into habitats if they put some work into that.
Right.
So they found an old wine press in the academy, had to fight all kinds of horrors therein. And Pablo asked me a question at one point as they were fighting something I had quite literally written into my notes as the last of the wine. That was the monster down in the press.
Okay. Like it's the last creature of, you know, whatever, because its species has just died out because everything's decaying, magical and fantasy-wise, I take it?
So this gets revealed a little bit later, but among the various fantasy tropes, the Grand Doyen, the head of the academy, is a vampire, was based on a vampire. So he keeps a wine cellar, and in order to apply to the academy, you must give your blood as a part of contribution, or as a contribution to the wine cellar, ostensibly so that you're safe.
Yeah.
You're preserved, as it were. The wine press that they were given as a place to turn into a residence was one of the earlier versions he had abandoned a while back. So, to a certain extent, yes, there's a bit of mad wizard lab experiment down there. There's a sense of forlornness and tragedy to whatever persists here, neglected.
Right.
And what that would subsist. But those were all tonalities that I had kind of just added in to play with them and see what the players resonated with. This was session 2 or 3. And there was an old stove that they managed to warm up. And Pablo decided that his character would, one, swallow the fire and then swallow the last of the wine, figuring they would neutralize each other. And this left me with a couple of conundrums, as you're probably going through yourself.
Yeah. As I'm thinking about the logic of that.
Now, kind of the third emergent rule was for me to assume that I didn't know all that was true to the world, and that the players, the characters they played, would help illuminate those for me as we went through the game.
Right.
So when he asked me, I would like to swallow the fire, and I could find nothing that says no, functionally, I was left a question of consequence. Now, the game we were running at the time was Dungeon World, which is a spinoff of D&D. The more important reason I bring it up here is that it had a resolution mechanic, which you and I are familiar with, as most folks who have heard our various story games probably are.
Post links here, yada yada. Go check out our other videos.
Of incredible success, hard choice, or abysmal failure. And regardless of what you roll, things always progress, right?
Right.
So there's an incentive to take risks because something will always happen that should be interesting.
Yeah.
So mechanically, there was nothing that automatically said you can't swallow fire. The greater unknown here is, okay, you do, describe it to me and tell me what you hope happens. Or you swallow it and I give you a hard choice. Or roll and see what the dice say. And then he succeeded well enough. I think there were consequences involved. But it started building up this narrative where they could actively bend the rules of the world in their favor, and sometimes not so, sometimes suffer drastic consequences, perhaps not to themselves, but to others, right?
Right.
The fourth rule, which is something their play reinforced, was that this was less a game and a story of combat and more of exploration. Because everything here is unique and fading, there was the desire to experience it and witness it and see it before it's gone away. And they bent over backwards in so many instances to not cause greater harm while often inflicting irreversible change. So
where have I heard something like that before? It's almost like we had a game like that.
Not my fault. I don't know what you're talking about.
Something about floating islands and dragon in the mountain.
There's always dragons in mountains. That's what they're for. So the question I posited to Andrew was, this is the setting as is, but we had in our conversation before with the group played around with other milieu environments. And the one we settled upon as the most interesting to us was small town America. What if we had the characters, the tropes, etc., and it was just this genre of narrative instead? What changes? And we never completed the exercise, but I'd dearly love to see where it goes with us today, because I think there's a lot that it evolves when you take such high drastic stakes and put them into a small space.
Yeah.
So how would you like to proceed with this? What's your order of operations when you create an environment for a story or a game?
So my typical, at least something that's worked for me for the past couple of games and campaigns, is I will start with a general area. Like, I'm trying to think how, for reference, like, it would probably be about like a quarter of the size of something like Skyrim, if I had to put a game on it, or something like a small area where it's like you have a couple of towns, usually a city, and then random ruins. Like, it's, if I had to put a number of landmarks, I'd probably say on average there'd be probably about 10.
So, for instance, the current adaptation of Sabrina, where Riverdale is the other town, but is also its own show. Right.
Yeah.
And, okay, so let's go with the geology known of the world and see how that adapts into a small town environment. That'll give us our town, the surroundings, and then we can give them a neighboring town.
I was going to say, yeah, because I usually do start with, like, okay, what is, like, the natural environment before humans and other magical things settle in?
Right. What's the normal or everyday? This will be interesting because the setting itself was largely abnormal. But right. There was a central town on the mainland. The academy was off on an island. The central town was called POTUS. Pardon me, POTUS. Not a presidential acronym.
I just
Although, you know, flip of the tongue, we'll let that lie for now. Maybe it becomes more true later. Okay.
Well, listen, we'll have a billboard outside that says POTUS. No, not that account.
Functionally, it is a podunk. It's a small town that just exists with its own environment. It is of no major import to the world around it, by and large. No offense to the town of Podunk itself, after which the word is coined. But so maybe it has a few names. Maybe it's gone through a few different histories. POTUS was a nod to Secret of Mana, which was a touchstone for flavor to certain parts of the narrative. So importantly, beneath the town of POTUS, there was a wellspring that was a font of strangeness and magical energies that seemed to be tied to the academy and was not the sea. It was water that was not the sea, but could go through it. Also, there was a sea. It wasn't the totality of water in the world, but you had an island on which the academy resided. You had the sea that separated that from the mainland, and then the mainland, which was mostly floodplains.
I imagine it's one of those, like, towns you'd see in, like, probably, like, the west coast, like, northern west coast, to take it, something like that.
Temperate climate, fair amount of rainfall because the mountains knock all the clouds back.
Yeah. Or
drain all the precipitation out of them before they can rise high enough to pass. There was a forest we called the Weird, or the Weird, and then the Mire, which was the swamp after that, as precipitation accumulated toward the mountains you couldn't pass.
Right.
And there was a strange old ruin in the mountains called Brennan's Barrow. Not ominous at all. So that was the main geography of the world. Most of the world outside of that existed at one point, but this was the remainder of the known world. So I think that's the first question we have here. Are we in a situation where only the town and its surrounding environments are known? Or is it simply that most people just stay in this environment, but it persists within a larger world?
I'd say that ultimately depends, because that is typically how I go about with campaign maps and everything, is that, like, I will have the general area. Like, even what we did with our D&D game, Like, we have the general area where there are these landmarks, there are things to do, there are quests, then we're done, and then we move on to the next. So I, at least for me, it ultimately is just, this is just a set piece of a larger world. But if we do want to, you know, we can experiment if we do just want to keep it like, no, this is just like, people stay here because there isn't much to the outside world.
Mm. I keep on forgetting the name, but it's not Found. I think it's From or something else. It's the show written by the folks who wrote Lost before. And that effectively is the premise, is that the town exists in a realm beyond the normal, and no one knows why or how. The only clue is that whenever people get there, there's always a tree blocking the road that they have to get out of their vehicle to maneuver around. And that tree is never in the same place because people come from everywhere. I don't know if, to your point, we'll answer that question, but let's work on the environments that we scale down first.
Right.
And I think actually, are you familiar with the television show Deadwood?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. In my grad school years, a friend of mine, Rob, and I had a chance to meet the writer, David Milch, and he shared with us the story of how Deadwood came to be, which I think is kind of a model we'll work with here. Milch wanted to write a show about symbolism, and he figured what bigger symbol is there in Western civilization than the cross, right?
Right.
So he wanted to write a show set in Rome and use the cross as a symbol upon which to explore various narratives. And he had drafted a fair amount of material, and then he went to the executives at HBO, and they said, "We love you, David. We're really happy working with you, but there's just one thing." And he goes, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, we got this show. It's called Rome. We're going to put out, and we don't want anything to compete with that. So, you know, we love you, right?
But we have another project set in Rome.
So could you just, you know, make it different?" And he was furious. But the one kernel they gave him was that next time you come up with a thing, whatever it is, we'll just do it. Okay. That's our compromise. So make your change here. Whatever you offer next, we'll green light it. And that way you can get your creative, you know, expression and autonomy.
You can get, it's like when you see like Martin Scorsese make something like, what is it? Like his more artistic thing. It's like, okay, you make something for the studio and then you make your art film.
So he made Deadwood and changed the cross to gold. And Deadwood became a show about anything that wasn't really cowboy-related being discussed through cowboys.
Really?
And
okay.
Greed and avarice and lots of cursing and shooting and other stuff. And
you know, all the fun stuff with gold.
Right. But the interesting part about it is that by shrinking down the space in which the narrative occurred, it made all of the allegories sharper. So I think if we have a sea, it becomes a lake, right? Small towns always have a lake or a quarry that fills up some part of the year.
So, something like that, yeah. Like I'd be hard pressed to find a small town, like you know, in media that takes place on a coastline.
Right, and I'm when I say always here, I mean within the context largely of narrative. Although humans like to live near water, so it's not entirely untrue.
Yeah, and typically lakes are like the if they do have a lake, it's usually like their fresh water source. Typically,
right. And I think the other fun thing about a lake is they're full of terrible things.
Yes.
Or
things that will become terrible later.
Right. I mean, look at the draining of Lake Mead now. They're discovering all kinds of wonders, quote unquote, in that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think our sea becomes a lake. And the sea in the narrative was hostile. It tried to eat or consume or devour or diminish whoever crossed it. I don't know if we need to have it necessarily as hyper-aggressive, but what of hostile sea do you think preserves within small town lake?
You know what I feel like it would be is this lake seems like, I'm trying to think, if we're trying to scale down the hostility of it, it could just be that, like, there's been so many instances of, like, kids and people drowning. They don't know why, though. Like, just, like, I feel like we need something like that where it's like, there isn't a clear, like, there's no lake town monster or whatever. It's just...
I like you just go, there's bodies in the lake, man.
Well, it's like, I'm picturing, like, something like at the end of Friday the 13th where Jason comes out. And I'm like I'm thinking of it like that. Because it's like, if we don't want it to be, like, super hostile where it's like, oh, there's old Nessie in the lake or something. Like, why don't we just make it that it's like, oh, there's just bodies in the lake. We don't know why, though. It's just a thing, and that's why it's seen as, like, hostile or a bad omen, just because, like, so many like kids or families have died in accidents on that lake?
I have an important question then. Typically, we don't drink in bodies of water that have bodies in them that are deceased.
Right.
At least not intentionally. We do in actuality, but that's a different story. Do you think people still fish in this lake and draw water from it?
I feel like draw water, yes. Fish, probably not.
Okay, so this lake has signage.
Yeah.
No swimming, no fishing.
Like, yeah, like, I would agree with that. Yeah, like, this is the lake the bad teens go to at night or whatever. Like, we're going to go to old Lake Albuquerque and, you know, swim, and then one of them goes missing the next morning, like that kind of thing.
So I'm going to borrow a name for this from a friend of mine who was writing a stage or a screenplay years ago in college, and it was called The Lago, which I believe is Latin for lake or Italian. It's been a while. And I think we're just going to call it The Lago.
Yeah, that works.
It has other names. They're probably not important because the thing you know is this is the lake that no one goes in.
Yeah, this is do not swim. This is people do not fish.
Importantly, the sea had an island with an academy on it. I don't think we put an academy in the lake. Do you think there's an island in the lake though, or some body? There's something in the lake that is visible.
Do we want? I would say we want to make it a big lake. Is the thing. Like, because
definitely.
I could see there being like a small, like just wilderness island in it. If we want to make it like a big lake,
right? So there's a temptation to go to it that is perhaps a rite of passage for a local youth or something.
Yeah, like it's your 80s spin on the oh boy becomes a man kind of thing. You know, you swim
right. It's the kind of thing you dare other people to go to as a rite of passage, and most of the time it's okay. Except for when it isn't, and then the local sheriff just stands there shaking his head.
Yeah, you get an old dusty cop car the next day at the no swimming sign.
Right. Okay, so we have a lake. How do you think things like the weir and the mire and the mountains and all that stuff translate?
Here's the thing, though, because I picture this going a couple of ways, because we couldn't, I could almost see this going like, because, like, I'm from Michigan, we could see it as, like, because on one hand, you do have, like, the, like, as I was saying earlier, like, the northwest-style small towns where it's like, oh, you got the mountains off in the corner. But we could honestly just set it up where it's, like, it's a big lake. There isn't too much mire, but there's a lot of, like, these rolling hills and just general, like, wilderness.
And wetlands.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so there's a lot of drainage areas where wildlife still pokes around. It sounds like, in a way, the safest part of the environment is the town, or the most normal part is, and then as you veer away from it.
Yeah, because, like, I'm honestly picturing, like, as you veer away from it, you get more of, like, these rolling hills where it's like, okay, you can't really settle or do anything with them, so they're just, like, there's, like, a long, like, one of the entrances to town is, like, a long bridge that's over Not a chasm, but like a small valley that's just because of how the hills are. And like the town would probably be next to, but not built on like floodplains that allow, you know, water to fill up every so often in wetlands.
Well, I mean, this is a Chekhov's gun inviting storms and the town getting flooded at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
Ooh, and of course, if the town gets flooded, then whatever makes the lake unsafe moves.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So we have Potos, we have the Lago, and I think up on the highest hill, there's still the academy. Because the eeriest thing about a small town that shouldn't have a big important thing in it is having a big important thing.
Important thing in it. Because like I can see it now. It's like, you know, you go, you got to take this one specific bridge that takes you to it, and it's like it's everybody who's in town sees it because it's so far off in the hills, but like, you know, you gotta take this one specific bridge because of the way the mountains turn and that kind of thing.
Right. So you gotta drive through the hills and the wetlands up to the lower part of the mountains, and it's kind of sitting right there looming over the town.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, important, was the academy there before or after the town was founded?
I feel like I would say maybe before.
Okay. Does anyone know how long before?
No. Let me put it this way. How about we say, because I'm picturing it more like the building was there before.
But it wasn't always an academy.
Yes, and no one knows. No, people know when the academy came into that building, but no one knows when the building itself was built or started there.
Oh, I mean, it was a winery. There's probably, if we're talking on the mounds, there's this whole scenic property,
yeah,
vistas. Yeah, this was a winery of some type. Maybe the environment changed, the weather changed. Investors,
yeah, exactly.
Went away.
This is old big bucks trying to make a winery wherever he can, and then the nature and weather proves them wrong.
Right, or the grapes are, or even, you know, here we go. It's bountiful but tastes awful.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's cheap, it's affordable, and no one else outside of the town wants it.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's always the first alcohol that's sold anywhere, and other grape derivatives are probably, you know, just constantly being peddled by local restaurants just to get.
Yeah. Like this is a grape orchard town where it's like, oh, we've got, you know, the grape festival coming up, like that kind of thing.
Right. So it's a town focused that used to be focused on the harvest. Maybe it's got other industries that have, you know, if there's.
I mean, it depends on the time period, but yeah, we can do. It's like if other, you know, depending on like what time period this is, like, oh, maybe other, you know, the big Walmart has started to settle in or that kind of thing, and other stuff has taken over.
Oh, when the Walmart is the ultra tour.
We got to have a Walmart or a mall if we're doing a small town.
Oh, I agree. I think the mall shows up somewhere. Okay. So the academy sits on the hills above the Myers. There's a bridge to it. And of course, the doyen or whatever his title remains, the weird vampire that is not a vampire figure, who's too old, who's too strange, who's too foreign, but is very wealthy and funds the whole thing. Is the academy free to the locals, or is there an unusual cost?
I feel like there should be a weird cost. Because, like, I think, here's the thing. If we're establishing the old, like, the headmaster or the guy who's running it as, like, he's not of the locals,
no.
I feel like he would make a weird cost for them.
Okay, so it would have to be something more. It's weird, but not it's weird, but not costly in the sense that it is.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you gotta like I'd say pay a membership fee or like something weird like that.
You know what it is?
What
he runs the local branch of the Red Cross.
Oh, so you got
blood drive is mandatory.
Yeah,
and it's for a humanitarian cause.
Exactly. You know, yeah. Totally.
Disasters outside in the world. We're doing what our best, you know, our bestness. We may be small, but we're prosperous, right? You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And for whatever reason, that's the only thing he requests of people if they wish to attend the academy.
And no one talks about the one truck that goes off to the academy at the end of the blood drive,
right? Or the fact that the wine press is still at least sometimes operational.
Yeah.
Or the strange lights and all the good, weird, eerie things.
You know, they don't question the old light that goes off every now and then when looking up at the hill.
It's not like he ever sleeps during the night anyway.
Yeah.
He's doing the research. So
exactly.
He was named Wadislaw in the series. And
oh, boy.
The ominous thing was that he was the fourth or fifth. I think if you're going to be some old country money in the true narrative sense, you can't be the first of a name, right? If we're going to play up to the expectations.
I would agree with that. Yeah, he is not the first of his name.
Right. And perhaps some of this is performative on his end. You know, he is a local figure and celebrity. So he's going to ham up in kind of the same sense as, was it, what's his, Things We Do in the Shadows? I'm trying to work back to the Jojo Rabbit, Taika Waititi, right?
Right.
So that level of weird eccentric who is not dangerous, but is just unusual in ways that you adapt to.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have the town POTUS, we have the woods, we have the mire, we have the mountains and the foothills around that. I'm going to give you some of the characters that were pivotal figures in the story. And you can tell me where you think in the town they would be and what roles they would persist in now.
Okay.
Okay. So this was a consequence of the players themselves, but there was this dynasty of a family called the Underwoods.
The Underwoods? Okay.
The Underwoods, which is a good small town name anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they've been there forever. And there are a few peculiarities to the Underwoods. One is that no one speaks to grandma or to mom.
Okay.
No one sees them either. They're around. They do things. No one sees them. No one speaks to them except the family.
Right.
And that for whatever reason, the wives always go missing if someone marries in.
Okay.
The other thing is that in the original story, they were a family dedicated to the hunting of monsters and other terrible things that go bump in the dark.
Okay.
But had a tendency to become them as well.
As a result of the hunting, I take it?
Yes. I know of no truer way to establish it than this question I asked at the very beginning, which is, you have a friend, there's another student at the academy, friend, foe, or family, who are they and why are they there? And Pablo, one of our players, chose his older brother, Adalbert, and said that my player, my character, Maximilian, will have grown up always in his shadow. When he meant that metaphorically, it did not remain so.
Really?
Yeah. We've talked about it on the show before, so I won't go into detail. But I think you have this family, the Underwoods, that are part of the way the town works, right?
Right.
They've been there forever. They've got a certain home. Maybe they live in other parts of town, too. But there's the Underwood home. So Papa, at least in this version of the story, was a big, gruff guy. I modeled him after the Golem, this terrifyingly immense, quiet, taciturn, not necessarily ill-meaning, but implacable.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, where in a small town do you think that individual goes?
I feel like I could see a couple possibilities. One, I feel like they could be like the sheriff or like the heads of like the police department, the whole Underwoods family.
Oh, are they a police clan?
Yeah. Or like, something like that where it's like, oh, don't mess with, you know, it's like they have like, they have the, like, let's say the sheriff department has like, they've got a couple like routine deputies, but you know you fucked up when Sheriff Underwood is there on scene, like that kind of thing. Like he comes out for the murders, the strange disappearances, and if like kids are going where they are not supposed to be.
Interestingly, does he particularly show an utter lack of interest in anything that isn't weird or unusual? Like, do you see Papa Underwood or Sheriff Underwood milling about doing everything that isn't sheriff related, even when normally?
I feel like, I would say he's like, when he's not sheriff, he definitely like takes the long walks in the woods at night, that kind of thing.
Yeah, comes back a little scratched up.
It's like he'll come back. It's like some nights it'll be peaceful, and then next night, hey, I found this raccoon or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel like he's either going out for a walk in the woods at night, or like he's like a weird old hunter that like is constantly going out and like checking, like he'll make like handmade traps or whatever. Like he's the guy that like makes the,
he's an outdoorsman in his spare time.
Yeah. Like he's the one that like, oh, I don't buy the fancy traps from Dick Goods or whatever. I make my own. Like he's the guy that, you know, they'd go to learn how to make the raccoon trap from where the red fern grows, like that log in the tinfoil thing. Like he's that kind of outdoors guy.
Oh man, there's a book. Okay, it's by Elizabeth Gilbert called The Last American Man. I remember she interviewed this fellow Eustace Conway, who lived in a suburban home and then at the age of 17 moved to the Appalachians, where he subsisted for a long time and then created this idea that he was the last American man because he lived the old way.
Yeah. You
know, salt of the earth and all that. I remember, this is years ago reading this. This is, God, 2003 or 4 at least. I know that sounds like forever these days. But, I was back in college. That's Papa. So, importantly, where's Mama Grandma?
I feel like he would have... The Underwoods would have like they have a good bit of property that's outside from the town, like not like so far out, but like it's where the, it's like before the bridge, before you leave town is, but there's still like the wilderness and everything.
Okay, so like
he's got a big piece of property. There's his cabin, there's Ma's cabin, and then old grandma's cabin, and like it's I'm picturing it like you've got Ma's cabin is similar to his own cabin, and then Grandma's cabin is like the old one that's just like the ones like whenever, you know, like characters are out in the forest and they just see an old cabin that's been there forever. That's Grandma's cabin.
So there was one last piece of location that I forgot because it's been so long, called the Pure Lands, which no one could go to because they've been sealed off forever by the folks who've invented the wine presses. And okay. Eventually, of course, like all good adventurers do, they went to the Pure Lands. And I bring this up because that's where Papa keeps his cabin. So, yeah, there's...
I can see that, yeah.
There is a... We'll not call it a sacred space per se, but the fence has talismans.
Yeah, like I can picture it as this like it's essentially like almost like a hunting compound, like out in the woods.
Yeah, hunting lodge of sorts.
Yeah.
With some properties on the side there.
Like even like I would say that it's like, you know, in, like you've got what makes it weird and why people stay away is like, oh, it's got like they like their whole fence has the like. The European style of like mounting deer skulls, but then everyone's no, like, yeah, like they see that and they're like, oh, you know, that's a little off-putting because there's so many, but then every once in a while, there's a weird like talisman that has like the skull of like a squirrel or something like that.
I just had this image that at some point, whether it's the town drunk, because there's always a town drunk, exactly. Or the local teenagers or whatever, they swear the skulls face you.
Yeah. That's the talismans, like one of the deer skulls has an eye still in it, and it never rots away, it just stays there.
Right, it could just be Papa screwing with you and putting a preserved eye in there or something.
Yeah.
Or it could be more, but it's, because I think part of the joy of turning into a small, of the small town Americana is that there's an element of folklore to this where you're unclear whether it's just things people know that most people don't, or whether it's something more.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the reasons I like it a lot as its own genre, if you will.
It's the reason Stranger Things works the way it does.
And then season 3 happened.
gosh, it's okay. Vecna never existed. He's not really, can't hurt you. There are other Underwoods, but I think that's enough for now. Let's move on to three of the other characters that started off the series. Since there was an academy, there were prefects. People who took over a year or a core at the academy. There were three prefects to the academy who were, by nature of being those who give shape to the classes and had the most free reign there, going to be weird to the utmost.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they remain in the academy in this context, but I'll lay out the three for you. And they were, I'm almost trying to think of ways to do this more archetypically. So let's call them. The witch, right? In the original game, Almathea was an example of how the world and the sea in particular destroyed things that had been magnificent. So they had found that were giants, you know, classic fantasy trope. But giants were strange collections of stone kept warm by small fires. And they craved heat more than anything else. They discovered this when they found out that the Academy used the bodies of giants as submersibles.
Okay.
Because the stone itself was impervious to the sea. And the sea wanted the heat, which meant the passengers were safe.
Right.
The revelation, though, was that giants had been stars who fell into the ocean and were nearly extinguished.
Really? Okay.
Which leads to the other thing, I can't believe I forgot this. Perhaps the other most defining feature of the setting. There was no sun. There was just a big old black hole in the sky that shed a watery light. And as the players discovered throughout their travels... The sun was on the other side. It was the hole left behind.
Okay.
And again, man, this is what happens when you veer away from things. Other side of a gate. There was a tremendous gate near the academy with the inscription, "What remains of time is left behind, left beyond." I forget the exact language. So The weirdest elements were there's no sun, just a hole where it had been. It's on the other side of a gate, which has an inscription, something to the effect of, "The remains of time lie or rest beyond here." Not that I want to put a giant honking obelisk in the town, because I think it's too overt.
Yeah, for small town America.
Right. Also, you know, the sun ceasing to exist and being an abomination that sheds light. I don't know if we, you know, if we're talking scaling down, let's scale those down, then we'll go to the prefects, because they're tied to those two things.
Okay.
So of the sun that's a hole in the sky or a gate that separates and divides two things, which do you want to tackle first?
I guess we could do the sun first.
Okay. So instead of a sun on the other side and a hole that's left behind, how would that phenomenon persist in small town America as a mythic location? Go ahead.
You know what I feel like it is? It's always overcast, but it's that type of like really thick, stormy overcast where it feels like it's almost nighttime, but it's like the middle of the day. You know, like when storms come in the evening and it's starting to get like darker out. Like I feel like it, like that's the always type of overcast, and there is something people can see as the sun,
but it's rarely sunny and a bright, yeah, shiny. Okay, there's always some level of dilution to light.
Yeah.
Okay. Although it's not yellow.
Yeah, like you could even put a spin on it that it's like it's the sun glows like the moon does at night. Only it's overcast and it's daytime.
Mm. Yeah, full moon is fairly bright. So brighter than that, but not as bright as the sun we're used to.
Yeah.
And that would explain why a vampire moved here.
Yeah.
Right? Minimal sunlight or diluted sunlight?
Yeah, like it's like they can just go out without having to hide themselves as much.
Right, which is why you obviously can't be a vampire. There's still sunlight out.
Yeah.
Sure. Not like he's supplementing himself and other things.
Exactly.
So the gate that divides one side from the other, what do you think that becomes? Or what do you see that as?
It could be a bridge.
Oh, is that the bridge to the academy?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking it could be. Yeah. I'd be fine with that, too. I was thinking like you get onto the academy property, uh-huh, and like a couple ways back, there's one of those like old stony bridges that like, you know, like the ones that go out in the severe storms, that kind of thing.
Sure.
But we could honestly do it as like the old, like the bigger bridge that leads to the property of the academy. That's fine, too.
Although I kind of like the idea that the inscription's just on a swinging wooden fence or a swinging wooden gate, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That it's something very small and mundane seeming, that you there's this place no one goes to. There's a wooden fence. There's a gate and scratched into it, painted onto it. Doesn't matter how often you remove it, is the statement.
Yeah. I can see that working, yeah.
Okay, so what's that gate surrounding? Or that fence with the gate surrounding?
I feel like it's got to be... I'd almost put it as, like, it's... You know, if, like, if you've ever seen photos of, like, abandoned, like, hospitals or insane asylums, where it's like... No, like, hear me out. I'm going somewhere with this. Because I'm picturing...
Gotta put a mall and an asylum.
As I'm picturing it as, like, an open space more... Like it's separated. Because here's the thing. I've seen photos where it's like that whole building is like a clear space and then there's woods in the background. Like I almost want to say that it's like it's...
You wanted a mall, right?
Is it the mall?
Where do malls get put where the property's cheapest and most accessible?
The woods.
Well, so maybe there had been something else here, or they just clear cut a bunch of the woods.
Yeah.
And maybe the only thing persisting, if this was, if not clear cut before, but partially overgrown, is the fence, and whatever was fenced in is gone.
Yeah, so it's just overgrown. Work, yeah.
Right. It's an overgrown fenced in property. And to respect the town, they left part of the fence with the gate as a thing, but the mall went down.
I can see that. Yeah. Like it's like right adjacent to the mall. Yeah.
And it feels like there was plenty of local protest, not just that we don't want a mall here per se. You know, or at least this kind of mall. Or if not that, then having it there, right?
Yeah.
Everyone like knows you don't put a thing there.
It's, you know, it's like it's going over old Dead Man's Woods or something. You know, it's like that place is no good. We don't go there, that kind of thing.
Right. Nobody builds crops there. Nobody builds homes there. Not even the stupid teenagers do rites of passage there.
You never hear the birds sing there, that kind of thing, yeah.
Right, which makes it, so no one else wants this property. It's dirt cheap. It's probably been, and there's probably been a for sale sign forever there.
it's been so overgrown that it's got grapevines on it.
You know, I could almost see that beginning, being a beat in the beginning of narrative too, where that sign... Or, you know, Sheriff Underwood comes out, so everyone knows it's a big thing, right?
Yeah.
It's early in the day. Sheriff Underwood comes out, makes everyone's following him along. Where's he going? Why is he going to the fence? Why the gate? And he picks up the for sale sign and walks off of it. Somebody's bought the property. And then over the course of the first part of that story, the mall gets built.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have this invasion of this entrance of a foreign external world to theirs.
For the sake of what we're doing here, we could just say corporate America
it's an expression of corporate America entering into their small town mythos and environment in the one place nothing should go.
Yeah.
So exactly. The act of him, of Sheriff Underwood picking up the sign and walking off with it, now you know something's going down.
Exactly.
And he doesn't say anything, he just keeps going.
Exactly, and he's the one who would do that, because it's like, you know, he's the one that is like telling kids and everybody, stay out of Deadman Woods.
Sure, Deadman's Woods, there you go.
Yeah.
So that means there's probably a couple crazy hermits in the woods, people think?
Yeah, like either hermits or we could even do there's been like an old couple of cases of like feral children or something like that, or feral men. I'm just saying, I think that would keep people away.
I'm laughing because you touched upon a thing that we had, again, things that were fantasy tropes that were evolved or modified or made sadder.
Yeah, yeah.
I blame Pablo in part for this, but we did a couple spinoff games and he wanted to play. We were playing Monster of the Week, so he chose the Cursed or the Hexed, and decided that he was an amalgamation of lost children's spirits, then called himself a goblin. And I was laughing because one of the earliest bits of lore I wrote was that in the old days, when the people who created the wine presses made them, it was to turn people, everyday folks, into heroes, that you would get pressed, and if you went through it properly and right, you'd become a hero. And that, in a sense, the ocean was at one point a wine dark sea, or is now, because perhaps they were a bit too excessive. So what is a goblin then but the souls of those who wandered off into the woods for adventure and never came back?
Exactly.
So yeah, there's probably, people have been lost, you know, tourists maybe got lost, etc. But there's stuff wandering around in the woods that cause mischief, if not problems, just mischief.
Yeah.
Could be very smart raccoons.
Could also do if we want to go more into the American folklore, could be like an actual Wendigo.
Wendigo are usually a bit more aggressive. But yeah, I could see the thing that fools people is that most of the time you only hear, I don't know if you live in areas with raccoons, but at night, they are noisy.
I do not, but I will take your word for it.
They scream, they shriek, they fight.
I could also, if we are like not doing something aggressive, I could see the raccoons being like the source of mischief.
I think the thing that I like is the motif here is that whether it's a raccoon or goblin, it has raccoon hands.
Yeah.
So at a glimpse, it just looks like some critters futzing around with things.
Yeah.
And they're probably coyotes and other usual possums and other stuff like that too. You know, your usual assortment of partially urbanized critter. Right?
Yeah.
That one could attribute these oddities to most of the time. A good story can excite us, yes. But the best ones, fiction or not, compel, inspire, or drive us toward the hope that we need for a better life. Remember, you don't need to know everything right now, but you do need to write. So make sure to like, review, and subscribe to us at Here Be Tigers. And until next time, take life by the tail.